Hello, this time on SITREP, Simon is back from Ukraine and gives us a unique insight from the front line, where the British Challenger tank is a much prized piece of kit.
I really like this tank. Our previous ones are very different, like the old T-80. The Challenger is far more manoeuvrable, it's big and spacious.
We also talked to former British Army officer Ed Arnold about the UK-led Joint Expeditionary Force, why he thinks it's had a decade of success, but his warning, use it or lose it. And Syria, a shock end to more than a decade of civil war, is followed by new military action from outside. So what is next?
SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
It was Ukraine in 2022, October the 7th, and the Israel-Gaza war last year. Now we've had the big curveball of 2024, Mike.
Yeah, another year, another war. I sometimes think I'm the fifth horseman of the apocalypse, in that I'm always reporting on, you know, new wars and conflict and related unpleasantness. But I think what is realistically happening is that international norms are breaking down quite quickly. And so things are very easily disrupted, and local forces now feel that that this is their moment. And that's exactly why the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham decided this was their moment to try to push in Syria. And suddenly, I mean, what's happening in Syria is geopolitically more important than anything that's happening in Gaza and Lebanon so far. That's all been big stuff created by the 7th of October attacks. But geopolitically, this is now rather more important. We'll have bigger consequences.
And we'll talk a lot more about Syria in a while. But first today, we want to welcome back Simon Newton. Simon, hello. When we spoke to you a couple of weeks ago, you were in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. But you had quite the journey after that, didn't you? Tell us.
Yeah, so we were in Kyiv for 3 or 4 days. Very interesting time. It was when the Russians launched that attack on Dnipro, and the US closed their embassy, etc. So that was all sort of going on. And then we headed east to Sumy, which is this region of Ukraine, which is bordered to the north and to the east by Russia. And it is where the Ukrainians pushed into Kursk from, effectively. So we had about a 6-hour drive. It's about 200 miles away to get to Sumy itself. And even just that experience is you feel like you're going towards a war when you drive down that road. It's the checkpoints become more frequent. We were held at one of them for about an hour or so while they were checking all of our documentation. You get a sense of the whole OPSEC that the Ukrainians have put around everything to do with this war, in terms of allowing journalists in and out of the front line. And it was just very interesting to see the amount of kit going forward. Every garage you went into, there was full of soldiers all buying food, etc., to take back to their you know, wherever they were. So we sort of went to Sumy. We stayed there for the night, which in itself, Sumy is quite an amazing place, because it was the route the Russians actually went through, or tried to go through, on their way to Kyiv back in February 22. And I think there was about 400 or so local people got together, guns, Molotov cocktails, and effectively stopped that advance by the Russians, or that stopped that route, made them go around a different way. So, it was a really interesting drive just to go there, to see the ambulances coming out from that frontline area, before we were then taken forward to one of these defensive lines which the Ukrainians are occupying at the moment.
And to be clear, Simon, you remained inside Ukraine, but some of the troops you met had been part of the force that invaded and seized the Kursk area of Russia.
Yeah, so we'd arranged to go and meet the 82nd Brigade, which was one of 6 brigades that went into Kursk at the beginning of August. So we were taken to a position in Sumy. We then got into a Stryker IFV, which is one of the American infantry fighting vehicles that the US has given to this particular brigade. And then we were taken forward to this position to meet the troops that were there. I think part of it was less actually the danger to us, more so they didn't want us to know where we were being taken. And then we were taken to 2 sort of locations, one where there was a Challenger tank dug in, because the 82nd is the only unit that actually operates the 14 Challengers that the British gifted to them last year. And then we were taken to a rear area, kind of staging area, if you like, where the troops are rotated in and out from that Kursk area. In there, we met a couple of troops who were particularly interesting to talk to. One of them was a chap called Ihor, who was a supermarket manager, I think he told me, before the war began. He led a detachment into Kursk at the start of that invasion. He was telling us about, you know, when they were told in the early hours of the morning that they were going across. This was him telling us a little bit more about that event back at the beginning of August.
To be honest, we'd all guessed something was happening because they'd moved us here to Sumy rather than to Zaporizhia or Vovchansk. I briefed my guys to be ready. I told them, guys, we're near the border. We're going to break through. And we did. All of them, the entire staff, cheered. We had a real confidence knowing that we were attacking them on their own land, and we're still doing it now.
And he was telling me that they were the part of the brigade that pushed the furthest into Kursk, sort of east of Sudza. They held back a Russian counteroffensive for about 35 days, they were saying. And he was telling me how tough the fighting has been for them there. This was the unit, obviously, that lost the Challenger 2 tank that was hit by a Lancet launching munition at the beginning of that cross-border incursion. And in fact, one of the driver that actually took us in, who was driving a vehicle, he'd been on board that tank. The commander of that tank was killed. He survived and was now on driving duties because of that. But we also met another young paratrooper who was lad named Ivan, who was 27, I think. He was from Kyiv. And he showed us around their camp and stuff, and he sort of just dropped into conversation that he actually shot down a Russian KH-52 Alligator attack helicopter at the beginning of that incursion. He showed me the footage of how he did it effectively, and this was him describing, shooting down that helicopter.
It was the third day of our raid into Kursk. We were dug in and we could hear helicopters. Our commander came out and said, watch the helicopter carefully, and when you see it on the horizon, destroy it. I fired and there was a lot of exhaust smoke. Then I ran into the trees and down into the dugout. I didn't even see it hit the helicopter, and I was asking the guys if I got it. They were congratulating me, shouting, so happy. Probably even happier than me.
And interesting, where you saw Ivan talking to me there, that sort of staging area is completely underground because of this drone threat. And we were sort of taken down into these underground bunkers where we were shown there. They've got pictures from their little kids on the walls like most dads would have. And it was sort of talking to us about that. They did all look really tired, I have to say. They denied they were, but they look exhausted to me. And they obviously are just waiting for the first snow of winter and this third winter of war ahead for them.
Absolutely fascinating, Simon, to hear those first-hand accounts there. Mike, it was a gamble by Ukraine invading Russian territory. It comes at a price. But right now, it does look like a gamble that was worth taking.
Maybe, yeah. It didn't pay off in the most central way of relieving pressure from the Russians further south towards Pokrovsk and Chazivyar and so on. The Russians seemed to be determined to put even more into that to show that Kursk didn't distract them. But there were two other advantages, or have been. One is that they're still holding on to it. And so if there's to be some sort of negotiation over a ceasefire next year, it will become relevant that they have got Kursk. And Putin clearly wanted Kursk to be settled long before any ceasefire negotiations. And I must admit, I'm surprised. I thought that Putin would put a lot more into recovering Kursk within a couple of weeks. So I'm surprised and I'm impressed that the Ukrainians have still got it. The other tactical advantage they've had is that it was pretty clear about 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago now, that the Russians had two divisions ready to strike westwards towards Dnipro, and that they clearly would intend to do that, but they didn't. They moved them to Kursk because they needed them there. And so I think the Kursk operation has already had an effect in actually relieving pressure that would have developed down in the southwest. So yes, they've got something out of it, but not what they really wanted, which was a big counterpunch that would really destabilize the Russian effort. It hasn't done that, but it certainly complicated it.
And Simon, you did get to see one of those British tanks, the Challenger 2. On the one hand, it's a single tank, but the stories attached to it and the people you met with it do give a real insight into the war.
Yeah, so we went into a wooded area, and I've been on lots of exercises, and you see British soldiers disguising tanks with camouflage netting and things like that. But this was quite incredible. You just literally couldn't tell there was a huge Challenger 2 tank there. They'd done such a good job of disguising it because of this drone threat, and they were telling me that I think 3 days earlier they tried to move this tank, and they'd been hit, or some buildings nearby had been hit with three glide bombs pretty soon afterwards. So they know they're kind of being watched. But yeah, we went and met this crew. Some of them have been welders a year before. You know, it was a real mix of guys. They love the tank. They love its accuracy. They love this this cannon that it has, the gun rather. But they're not so keen on its mobility. This is a story we're quite familiar with, that they find it difficult to move around in the mud of Ukraine with the track pads that it has on the Challenger. So this tank, like many others, I believe, of the Challengers particularly, are dug in, and they're using them as kind of like self-propelled howitzers, you know, mobile artillery effectively, rather than moving them forward. But what they love this tank. They had been in combat. If you've seen the pictures of them going forward into Kursk, this particular unit, you see them being hit by drones. One guy was telling me they got hit four times by Russian helicopters, attack helicopters, in one attack, and they all survived that because of the armor that's on the Challenger. So they were very, very fond of it indeed. But it was fascinating to see it, but they had disguised it so well, I have to say. It was so difficult to even find it.
Mike, clearly the Challenger 2 is valued by Ukrainian troops. We gave them 14 2 years ago. Two have now been destroyed. But let's put that into context. Ukraine has had at least 700 tanks destroyed, almost 300 more damaged, abandoned or captured. What we've given looks like a drop in the ocean. But if we gave any more now, could it make any difference?
Well, it would if we had them to give, but we just don't. I mean, 100 Challenger 2s would make a difference, but we don't have 100 Challenger 2s ourselves, which are actually serviceable and ready to go. So it's a sort of an academic question. But in principle, of course, if the Ukrainians could get hold of Leopard 2s, Challenger 2s and Abrams M1s, if it could get a couple of hundred of those, it would make a difference. But the fact is, you know, the 14 that we gave was really part of the tank coalition. We were the first one to give tanks, and they were all that we could really offer at the time. But it broke through the political barrier of saying Western countries are prepared to give tanks to Ukraine. We were never able to give more than a handful, and we couldn't now even. But if Germany were to step up with more Leopard 2s, and the United States, it's not likely to, but was to give a lot more Abrams, they would make a difference. But you know, when we're talking about this sort of warfare, you talk about tank numbers in the dozens and low hundreds that make a difference, not in the up to a dozen. Anything less than a dozen is, I wouldn't say it's not neither here nor there, because these tanks do perform well. But ultimately, this is about scale as much as it is about technology.
Simon, what was the mood among the troops you met?
Well, it's sometimes difficult to judge, because you're obviously with army brigade press officers and you know full well that these are soldiers who kind of do what they're told and say what they're told. But I think they looked genuinely tired, as I said before. Their mood and morale didn't seem bad. They seemed quite stoic about what they were doing and about Kursk. They're fully aware of what's coming down the tracks with Trump and all the uncertainty around that. And that was the kind of key word, I think. But they seemed in pretty good spirits, I have to say.
Simon, stay with us for a little while, because next we're talking about the Joint Expeditionary Force, which I know you have also seen at work firsthand. It is a British-led, high-readiness, multinational force of Northern European nations created 10 years ago in the weeks after Russia's first invasion of Ukraine and annexation of Crimea. It's meant to complement NATO without directly being part of it. New research concludes the JEF has had a successful first decade as a political and military power maximiser, bringing benefits to the UK. But it comes with a warning for the future as well. That research was led by Ed Arnold from the defence think tank RUSI, himself a former army infantry officer. Ed, good to have you on SITREP. Welcome. How do you actually measure the JEF as a success?
Well, going back to its first principles and its design of being a formidable military force within NATO, it now unarguably is. It is led by the UK, which is the only other European nuclear power to assign its nuclear forces to the defence of NATO, which thereby extends that nuclear guarantee to JEF members, which is pretty critical for a lot of the JEF member states, five of which border Russia. And then back in 2014, I think one of the most significant data points is that it was only the UK that met the NATO 2%, and now this year in its 10th anniversary, all meet the 2% and the 20% guideline amounts on new equipment spend. And also a lot of the most sophisticated military capabilities in Europe are from the JEF. So, for example, 5 of 11 air forces within Europe also operate F-35. So as a vanguard military grouping, as a third of European NATO members led by the UK, it is very significant.
And is it a military heavyweight structure that adds to deterrence, or given it's never been into battle and doesn't have a standing force, is it still more of a concept?
No, I think it does add, but I think it needs also to do more work in trying to explain its contribution. I mean, generally in terms of deterrence, I mean, it can have activity, but I don't think we should mirror to our view of deterrence and what the Russian view of deterrence is. I heard during my research some people saying, well, the JEF might be less escalatory than NATO in certain regards, but that's only if Russia notices the JEF and knows what it is and generally sees NATO activity in the north as US activity anyway. But actually, the issue with NATO is that when it moves up the escalation ladder, it moves up quite in a linear fashion, because it has to go to the NAC to decide what to do, and it's quite measured. It can be quite slow. So at those points that you need increased deterrence value, actually the JEF can step in there to sort of just try and peak at certain times when the situation is necessary. So that's where the complementarity is. But I think it is something that the JEF needs to articulate more, largely outside its membership. I think communication within the JEF is very good within its members, but it gets its legitimacy from NATO and actually focus out that way a little bit more.
And Simon, you've actually been on exercise with the JEF. What have you seen them doing exactly?
I think the first point is just going to what Ed's just said. This is my first experience with the JEF and trying to understand what it is. When you come from a sort of conventional body like NATO, which is easy to understand, and it's quite nuanced, I think, in its things. So as a reporter, to try and understand it was quite difficult, actually. And even some of them struggle to explain exactly what it is sometimes and what it actually does and where it sits between these two things. So I went to Keflavik Air Base in Iceland, which is a former US base. So the Americans have still got some P-8s, I think, some anti-submarine aircraft there. But we were down in a nuclear bunker inside this base. I call it a nuclear bunker because it was just a very deep bunker. And they'd effectively taken the HQ from Northwood and they'd moved it to Keflavik. And that was the exercise, effectively, how you logistically move a whole base. The staff, etc., everything down to, you know, the tables, the pens and pencils, everything was going to Iceland. They were working out of this underground bunker, I think, for about a month or so. It was tri-service. We were in a control room with lots of screens, watching different things going on around, you know, the high north, the Arctic, etc., monitoring these undersea cables and pipelines and things, which is one of the things that they obviously look at. So it was really interesting for me to see how they work. But I think very much to what Ed was saying there, the communication of what it is something they maybe have struggled with outside of their own, you know, body. So that was very interesting for me.
And Mike, you were there at the beginning when the JEF was announced at the Wales 2014 NATO summit. Is the JEF today what was promised back then?
Well, in a way it is, because that's what NATO was doing at the time. It was setting up, as it were, new arrangements and structures. It was reinforcing its battle groups, and it was calling out Russia as the problem. Just remember, it was 2014. So this is where you would have more or less expected it to be. But what has happened, of course, is that the context has changed in the meantime. You know, with the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 22, fundamentally European security has changed. So now, as Ed Arnold said, the time has come for JEF to really step up. So yes, it's exactly where you'd expect this sort of thing to be in the days when NATO was dealing with Russia as an issue, not as a manifest threat to the rest of Europe. So yeah, the time has come for JEF to actually put some real flesh on the bones, I think.
Okay, Ed, so your report warns that the next 10 years for the JEF is going to be more difficult, and there's a risk of the force suffering atrophy, basically withering from neglect. How so exactly?
Well, the thing is, is what European defence and security frameworks do when they lose a bit of momentum. They suffer. You know, they don't stop trading. The auditors and, you know, don't come in and they sort of cease trading. They carry on. So it's very difficult to actually assess the health of some of these defence frameworks, because they're really built on confidence and trust. So I think for the JEF, it's very important that it continues the momentum of its development. And as Mike just said, I mean, this is the time to really step up, especially as a lot of European nations look to leadership within Europe. And, you know, there's political difficulties in France. There's sort of early elections in Germany as well at the time that Donald Trump resumes his presidency within the US. So everyone's going to look to the UK, and also within it, the JEF, you know, the leadership of a third of European NATO members. So that momentum's really got to continue. My worry at the moment is there's a bit of a risk on the policy side, which is you have a leaders meeting in Tallinn next week, and there's another one due in Oslo only in May. So really you've got 6 months between leaders meetings to really have a sort of policy sprint on JEF and sort of elevate it up. And already it's been 187 days since the Labour Party manifesto said about development of JEF, but there has been nothing as of yet. So I worry that momentum's stalled a little bit and Tallinn really needs to sort of kick it into gear. And then operationally, I mean, it's been 25 days now since there were cables damaged within the Baltic Sea, again by a Chinese flagged vessel, echoes the Baltic Connector incident of 2023, when the JEF then had a joint response option. It deployed forces to the Baltic Sea. They did it again earlier on this year as well, in order to provide deterrence. You know, 3 and a bit weeks after, absolutely nothing from the UK, absolutely nothing from the JEF, which is a core activity within their core region. And it really puts the Danes in a pretty difficult position. And they have the Yipeng 3, which is the main, the vessel which is suspected of damaging those cables, moves into Swedish waters. Also a Swedish problem. And really, I'm very surprised that there's been nothing from the UK or the JEF, because it's going to be a diplomatic incident if the Danes or the Swedes have to board a Chinese vessel, a really big geopolitical incident. And well, what could happen? Well, the UK as a P5 nation, significant NATO member, they could really diplomatically support the Danes to say, well, whatever you think's necessary, we back you. But thus far, it hasn't been forthcoming. So this is where I talk about sort of confidence and trust, that it actually can erode. And if it does, then yes, the JEF will likely atrophy. I mean, it'll still exist, but people will think, well, actually, maybe it's not up to what it suggests it is. Why don't we just put more effort into NATO?
Yeah, Ed, I mean, you say you were surprised by the lack of response from the JEF and from the UK to that cable incident. What do you have an explanation? Have you asked questions? Why?
I've asked questions. Nothing as of yet. And the risk for the JEF is, so on the 28th of November this year, just shortly after, there was a Nordic-Baltic NB8 meeting that happened in Sweden, and the Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk went there. Emmanuel Macron even zoomed in to say hello, and they discussed sort of the usual things that JEF nations might discuss. And also at the time, the Polish president said, well, also we're going to look at more joint patrols within the Baltic. And going back to Simon's earlier point, it's an issue that the JEF has never been able to answer, is how do you operate in the Baltic Sea without the Germans or the Poles? Especially as the Germans run NATO's Baltic Maritime Command. And then also that we're seeing today that Macron is going over to see Tusk to talk about potential deployments in Ukraine if we move into a negotiated phase of the war. Again, talking about future European security issues of great salience. The UK is not there at the moment. And I think, again, this is where I worry both on the policy side and the operational side, which is a benefit of JEF. Most defence frameworks are only on the policy side. We have a command and control arrangement led by the UK, which is well-tested, set up in 2015 under the Standing Joint Force Headquarters. So again, with all of the advantages that I identified from the JEF in my paper, it's use it or lose it. And if we're not using these advantages of the JEF, it will just wither. People will still talk about it, but I think people will not invest in it in a way that they have up till this point.
And Mike, one of the points in Ed's report is that the JEF could set the pace and standard for Europeanisation of NATO. But this then reminds me of the concern that you've raised before about the different priorities of the northern and southern NATO members. And JEF is definitely north-focused. Does it risk dividing rather than complementing NATO?
Well, that's something that Sakur does worry about and his office worries about because, you know, NATO is an organization of 32 nations and there is a clear difference between the natural security agendas of the northern members and that of the southern members. And as Ed's report makes clear, I mean, the JEF nations are the most proactive, the most militarily competent of all of the European NATO nations. So there is a danger that this looks to Sakur like only the northern members. So in a way, yes, I mean, yes, they have to act. I mean, the government's defence team is really keen on JEF, but they're keen on talking about it. They need to make it work. But they've always got to nuance what they do within what Sakur also wants, which is that something that is a benefit to the whole of NATO, not just to the northern part of NATO. So there is a bit of a balancing act there, but we shouldn't allow those, as it were, those hesitations in Sakur's office to detract from the main thing that JEF now needs to act. And Britain is meant to be the leader of it. Time to lead.
And Ed, inevitably, security of the NATO-Russia border takes up almost the entirety of the public focus. But the Arctic and High North is a big part of why the JEF was created. Can you just explain a bit more about the reason for that and what the JEF can bring?
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, it's interesting that the JEF initially was, I mean, and it still is, when you read the policy documentation, a global force, that it can operate anywhere in the world, but it's been more focused on Northern Europe, especially in the last couple of years, and its core regions described as the North Atlantic, High North, and the Baltic Sea. I recommended that the Arctic should specifically be called out there as well, because it helps the UK engagement particularly, and also brings the JEF far more in line with US strategy within the Arctic, identifying the Arctic as probably the sort of the focus point for great power competition between the US, China, and also Russia. But the issue is operating up there militarily. I mean, it's really harsh environments, whether land, air, and sea. And the JEF nations, generally speaking, have all of those capabilities that allow it to operate in the north. And I think it's a wider point that sort of Mike alluded to just there within NATO. I mean, the 360-degree approach that was agreed at the Warsaw Summit in 2016, I mean, that's assured politically by US leadership. If US leadership starts to take a back seat under President Trump, then actually to keep NATO together in close to its current form, I think has to move down the regional approach, which is actually, it was in its first strategic concept in 49, which was these five regional planning groups, of which the North was one. So I think the JEF has a lot more to play in also taking a lot of military tasks from NATO, sea lines of communication protection, assuring transatlantic reinforcements so the US can get over to the Nordic and Baltic states to fight. You know, these are all tasks that the alliance has to do. The JEF could take them off the alliance, and this is where I say about stepping up. It's about looking at military tasks that the Europeans and the Americans need to do, finding out which ones the JEF is very good or well configured to take, and then offering up and saying, well, we will do this on your behalf.
Ed, really good to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time today. Ed Arnold, thank you. And Simon Newton, thanks very much as well. You can read more of Ed's thoughts about the Joint Expeditionary Force at 10 on our website, forcesnews.com. And on our YouTube channel, you can watch Simon's films with Ukrainian troops at the front line. Okay, let's finish with Syria and just take stock of where we are today before we look forward. This is a country where a brutal dictatorship held on through more than a decade of civil war. That dictatorship suddenly crumbled in the space of days, leaving HTS, a militant group previously allied to Al-Qaeda, seemingly in charge. Those events have been followed by new military actions. Israel, already fighting in Gaza and Lebanon, sent ground troops into Syrian territory and also carried out hundreds of airstrikes. The US also carried out dozens of airstrikes in central Syria less than 24 hours after President Assad fled to Russia. Mike, does that cover the key points for now?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, we've got HTS, which is an Islamist group in control, but then lots of other groups who don't share their agenda. So it's a patchwork of interests. And the issue is, can this, you know, so-called moderate Islamist government, first of all, is it really moderate or will it turn into the Taliban? And that's the great fear. And if it doesn't turn into the Taliban, can it still somehow unite these interests, which are really quite different? And on the basis of that, Turkey is taking advantage in the north to pursue its war against the Kurds, and Israel is taking advantage in the south to try to reshape this part of the Levant, which is what it claims now to be trying to do as a result of the Gaza war. So the basis of all of this, my sense of it, is that this Syrian civil war is taking place on the confluence of three other wars. Israel's war in Gaza and Lebanon, Turkey's war against the Kurds, and United States' war, America's war, against ISIS. So there's three external wars going on in the middle of this Syrian civil war.
It's incredibly complex, isn't it? On the point about Israel and its ground campaign, it is already committed on two fronts. So why is it opening up a third?
Yeah, I think sheer opportunism. Funnily enough, from Netanyahu in his trial yesterday, I mean, who would have thought that a prime minister would be in the witness box accused in a trial on corruption while he was invading a foreign country? It sounds like something out of even a Jeffrey Archer novel, you know, might stretch for that one. But there he was, and he actually said, we're fighting on seven fronts. You know, not just those three fronts, but we're also, by implication, you know, fighting on a front on the West Bank, and we're fighting on a front in Yemen, against the Houthis. So in theory, they're fighting on seven fronts. But this particular front, this third front, which, and you're right to call it that, is opportunism and fear that an Islamist government in Damascus, which after all is very close to Israel, would then be physically close to the Israeli border, that Islamist government, if that's what it became, would be a real threat. So the Israelis are preemptively destroying as much of the military structure of the old Syrian army as they can before this government has a chance to really get itself moving.
And there was an interesting thread posted on X on Monday by Naftali Hazoni, who describes himself as an Israeli fighter pilot turned combat special forces. I just read you a bit of the thread and what he wrote. Israel has conquered Mount Hermon, the highest mountain in Syria, 40 kilometres from Damascus, putting the Syrian capital in range of Israel's artillery shells. He also points out that Mount Hermon has effectively blocked Israel's northern defences, creating a radar blind spot looking into Syria and parts of Lebanon, which has been exploited by Iranian low-flying drones. Now Israel, he says, can put radar and communication sensors on the top of the mountain, which can look far into both Syria and Lebanon. That also means, he says, they can see Hezbollah smuggling routes and use the mountain as cover for Israeli special forces operations. Wow, Mike, if nothing else, it's a really good illustration of the very complex connections in the region.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, in legal terms, Israel's got actually no right to be there because this is a mountain right in between the Syria-Lebanese border. So it's got nothing to do with Israeli territory. But of course, in the first place, it does. It creates a blind spot for Israeli radars as it were looking outwards. And if you hold Mount Hermon instead of the Syrians holding it or Hezbollah holding it, if the Israelis hold it, then it gives them, not just takes that blind spot out of the picture, it gives them a huge advantage looking the other way. So it's an absolutely central and important military objective. Legally, the Israelis have got no business there. Tactically, it makes perfect sense. And that's the world that we're in at the moment. Israel says, look, we're fighting a war for our survival. We'll do whatever it takes.
And Israel says that incursion into what is supposed to be a buffer zone is temporary. But that analysis on X makes a case for why Israel might actually want to annex more of this territory permanently.
Yes, I mean, temporary is a very flexible term, and we've seen Israel's temporary incursions before. I mean, you know, one of them was in 1982, and that went on, you know, for about 18 years. The problem is that Israel thinks in these tactical terms. While people who sit here with the luxury of not having to fight for their survival, we talk strategically, the Israelis feel that they are up against a very immediate threat. And if they think that Syria will be taken over by a really Islamist government, if they think they'll be facing a kind of a Taliban in Damascus, then I'm sure they will annex a certain amount of Syrian territory. I mean, I think everything is up for grabs at the moment because Syria is a really important territory. It's a big country, 25 million people. It's much bigger than Lebanon, much bigger than Israel, far bigger than the Palestinian territories in geographical terms. And who controls Syria? is really important to Turkey, to Iran, and to Israel.
And that buffer zone is supposed to be maintained by UN peacekeeping troops. Can they, will they actually do anything about this?
I think it's doubtful. They can act as observers, but there's not much they can do. And they certainly, in the middle of a war, they don't have the capacity or the arms to actually prevent anybody from doing very much. I mean, there's 10,000 of them in UNIFIL, United Nations Force in Lebanon. They've been there since 2006. The last time I looked, two of them were British. They were there for liaison purposes. So I think UNIFIL are a force that could be expanded if there was some sort of ceasefire deal that needed to be enforced. But it would have to be expanded, it would have to be tripled or quadrupled to have any real effect. But 10,000 sounds like a lot, but it's not a lot when you're trying to look after so many different parts of a very volatile front. So I think the best we can expect from UNIFIL is to act as a reasonably impartial observer service to actually monitor what they see and what they can find out about what's happening on the ground.
And let's look at the Israeli airstrikes. They destroyed Syria's navy. How much of a threat did that pose to Israel, and how much difference will its destruction make to the world at large?
Not much in either case. I mean, the Syrian navy was neither here nor there in terms of its ability to threaten Israel. And in a way, taking it out, taking it off the table for the new government is almost like an act of spite, because there's almost nothing they could have done with it that would do them any good. As targets go, I think it was just my guess is it was just an easy target. It's more important for the Israelis to have gone after weapon stocks and maybe weapon production facilities. And if they can prove it, chemical weapon stores, and nobody's entirely sure how much chemical weaponry the Syrians had. They certainly used it well over 200 times after 2013, so they certainly had chemical weapons. If the Israelis have destroyed some of those stores, then that could be a benefit to the region in general, but even that's not entirely certain, so we still need to wait, I think, until we can work out what it is that has been destroyed. Again, makes tactical sense from Israel's point of view. It's not a great example of observance of international law.
Indeed. And Mike, the US airstrikes, it says they were against the Islamic State terror group. Big picture, no tears are going to be shed in London or Washington about the fall of President Assad. But it's also a case of be careful what you wish for. Power vacuums and ungoverned spaces, we know well, are where jihadi militant groups grow and thrive.
Yes, and the although there have been pretty extensive American airstrikes, there was, I think, 75 on the first night, and there have been quite a lot of follow-up since, run from CENTCOM, from Central Command, there is still quite a lot of evidence that ISIS fighters are moving around in the region and are moving into Syria. So even with American airstrikes, there's only a certain amount you can do. It's the old problem. Without boots on the ground, and there are not going to be many American boots on the ground, you really can't stop infiltration of certainly hundreds of fighters moving westwards in such a big, deserted region. There's all sorts of ways they can move around. And that does seem to be happening. So although American airstrikes will be having some effect, they won't be able to stop ISIS people moving into Syria, and we'll see what sort of effect that may have.
And how great is the risk that Syria turned into a new and different war zone?
I mean, that's quite a high risk at the moment. Of course it is. We all hope that some sort of stability can be achieved and that HTS will turn into a competent government that really can include the different groups who make up part of Syria's patchwork of population and demographic interests. But it's not clear that that will be the case. But, you know, let's look again in a month's time. Most of us are fairly pessimistic about this. We think that Syria will turn into a relatively ungoverned space. But that's not inevitable. And a lot of it will depend on the way the outside world reacts to the HTS government as it tries to get going. So far, in the first few days, it has by and large done the right things. So far, you put ticks in the boxes. But, I mean, the things it's done so far have been very preliminary, and there will be a great deal of rough justice. There'll be a great deal of local retribution. There's already quite a lot of evidence of that. And somehow HTS have got to prevent that and make sure that they are not part of it, and that may be quite a big problem.
And Turkey, a NATO member, is a key backer of some of the opposition forces in Syria. If this does deteriorate into a new war, what's the risk of the alliance with it, and with it the UK, getting drawn in under Article 5?
Oh, I don't think we need to worry too much about that, because if Turkey were operating inside Syria, an attack on a country that's not on its homeland doesn't raise the Article 5 problem. So, you know, any NATO member operating, you know, abroad, as it were, is not covered by Article 5. It only covers the homeland of the 32 NATO members. So, and even if Turkey, you know, were attacked in its homeland in a bigger way than we've seen so far, even that wouldn't necessarily trigger Article 5 unless it was another government attacking Turkey as opposed to a rebel group or the PKK or whoever it might be.
And Mike, you often tell us history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. What's this rhyming with?
Oh, whenever there's chaos in the world like this, I always think of W.B. Yeats. And he always says, you know, the centre cannot hold, the best lack all conviction, and the worst are full of passionate intensity. And that's what happens in periods of instability and revolution. You know, the best lack all conviction, the worst are full of passionate intensity. But there's also, I think, you know, Seamus Heaney, you talk about the history, you know, not repeating itself, but rhyming. And Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet, only died about, I guess, 10 years ago. He always said that, you know, that the world, that history teaches us not to hope this side of the grave. But he said, but sometimes, just sometimes, hope and history rhyme. Sometimes hope and history rhyme. And I guess in respect to all the good people of Syria, 25 million of them, I'll go with Seamus Heaney for now.
Mike, thank you so much. And my thanks to all of our guests. That is it for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest defence news on our website, forcesnews.com. For now, though, from me, Kate Jabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.